Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting a movie that we think you'll find interesting. In this episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the movie Argylle from 2024 that was on...
It's currently streaming on Apple TV.
So it's on Apple TV.
It was a theater movie originally, I believe.
Okay, it's hard to keep track of these things. And it's, what, 2 hours, 10 minutes-ish, mm-hmm. give or take. But it moved along reasonably well, so it didn't feel like it was too long of a movie.
Well, I do want to start with, I think we're going to have very different impressions of the movie, because I read the book, and you didn't.
Right. I'm also a little intrigued by the fact it seems to be connected to the Kingsman franchise, and I've read some of the comics that you have not, and we did an episode on Kingsman the Secret Service back in, I want to say 2016.
Eons ago.
I knew Henry Cavill was in Argylle. It was a spy sort of a thing, but not a standard spy film. And while I enjoyed this, it was not exactly what I was expecting it to be. And the tone and style, I felt, was uneven.
For me, it was a bit schizophrenic. It was like two movies were happening side by side.
I wouldn't say side by side. I think two movies were fighting for screen time.
Yeah.
Because we start with Henry Cavill being a James Bond type agent of Argylle. His support guy is John Cena. So you've got Superman and the Peacemaker as spies. It's like, okay. But then we realize this is an adventure that somebody did as a novel. And I'm like, well, how does that work? I was confused by that. And then the novelist meets somebody who claims to be a spy. And then we start cutting between his action sequence, because that's Sam Rockwell's character, with Henry Cavill in that action sequence and stuff. And it's like, it was clear what they were doing. It was unclear what they were trying to do, I should say.
Yeah. Well, for me, they were trying to say that she couldn't believe her eyes. For her, it would only make sense if it was the fictional character doing it, because it couldn't be reality.
Well, the other take I had was, here's a writer, she's got to write that last chapter of a book.
Yeah.
Here's somebody that if she fictionalizes it, here's that next chapter.
Yeah.
So, it was hard to know if what was happening was literally happening, or if this was her embellishing innocuous events that were happening.
Yeah. Well, and he tells her, when they're first meeting up, and he's finally explaining what's happening, that she's a bit of a fortune teller. That her books are predicting what's happening in real life, but then later it's, well, actually you're writing your memories from 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And we need to know what happens next.
Which, on the face of it, makes absolutely no sense. If you know she's just regurgitating her memories from 5 years ago and you're trying to continue the case, she can't, quote-unquote, predict what's going to happen. She can try to finish the case.
Yes.
But there was a lot of what's real, what the hell's going on, and
why is it a crisis? We need this now, but it's been waiting 5 years.
Yeah, it's been on hold for 5 years. Why is it suddenly a big deal? But when we've got all of this, what's real, what's the truth and stuff, by the time we get to like the big action sequence at the end, well, the opening action-adventure stuff was very blatantly CG effects. The ending stuff was not only blatantly CG effects, but ridiculously unbelievable CG effects.
Yeah.
I mean, the ice skating on an oil slick, while it was a, I'm not going to say a clever idea, to me it was a predictable thing.
Well, and using knives for the blades of the ice skates.
I was thinking they didn't even need knives, it's just instead of walking on it, slide on it.
Yes, yes.
Like you're ice skating. So to me, that was obvious what was going to happen. But then when we get the smoke effects with the smoke bombs and stuff, and it's forming hearts, and it's very clearly CG smoke and whatnot. I mean, they've got an entire... They're in the armory, they've got to bust out, and all the enemy agents are outside waiting for them, and they know it. When we get that action sequence, unlike, say, the hallway scene in one of the early seasons of Daredevil on Netflix, yeah. It was just beautifully done. This was so blatantly filled with special effects, people being composited in, and stuff like that. And it's like, wait, we're trying to get to what's real, what's true, and it's so blatantly false.
Well, and when they finally create a mood, I'm like, okay, fine, I'm going to accept the mood you've created, even though I've worked through the quandary you've got. Then we cut to the control room, where we've gone from the plane cameras to the thermal cameras, so we can see what's happening. And then we cut back to the room full of smoke. Like, so every time you get me into the mood you want me in, you throw me right back out of it.
Well, and when we got the thermal imaging, there was an aspect of, was this her delusion of what was happening?
Yes.
Versus what was really happening? Because we've all seen the kinds of movies where you've got the person who thinks they're doing the big action sequence and stuff with skill grace. And grace.
Yeah.
And then you cut to and they're just floundering around or whatnot.
Yeah.
Because that's a go-to way to spoof the action sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was a fun movie, but there were aspects, you know, even as the beginning opening scene where Argyle, as played by Henry Cavill, is trying to seduce somebody. She knows he was coming, so the entire thing is a setup. He gets out of it, but she's on the run. She's going down the street that's doing this wild S-curve back and forth.
Yeah, the switchbacks.
Back and forth. He winds up getting into... It almost looked like a toy version of a Hummer.
I was thinking a toy version of a Jeep.
Yeah, yeah. And just barreling straight across the switchbacks and stuff on the roofs in a very blatantly CG sort mm-hmm. of a deal. It's like, well, she's taking the long way. He's just going to plow straight through. And it's hard to take that too seriously because when he comes doing the 90-degree turn to a stop or whatever, it's like, man, this is so clearly CG affected in... It was undercutting it. And your yeah. theory at the time was, well, once we get to the real, quote-unquote, action...
Well, are they trying to not do the best effects when this is her imagination of the novel come to life? So when we get to reality, we'll have the good effects, and it'll look real. And they stepped it up some.
Yeah, but even when she's getting pulled out of the train
yeah.
with the parachute... That was very clearly CG. Almost any time anybody's in a car,
yeah,
it looked like a 50s TV show car with a film in the background.
Yeah.
And I can't tell how much of that was intentional, but it was in some places off-putting, in other places a little insulting, and then in other places utterly ridiculous what the action was. And it's like, is this a comedy or is this not?
Well, it didn't help that we were getting the movie and the story through Ellie Conway, whose mind is being messed with throughout the movie.
Yeah, because to say we have an unreliable narrator, literally the narrator at the beginning of Ellie, because she's apparently telling us the opening action sequence and stuff, we find out she's a bit of a false persona brainwashed into
yeah.
Rachel Guile.
Rachel Kelly. R. Kelly.
Argyle.
Argyle, sorry. Argyle? Okay.
There are times yes. I wonder if we watched the same movie, and this is one of those times.
Well, they threw enough names at us and they confused did. Me enough.
They did. But
yeah,
when she's got this whole persona built in, but then that kind of breaks, and then at the end, there's these post-hypnotic command code words or whatever to turn her into a killing machine.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it sort of makes sense they would have done that, but it's like, there was nothing to set that up.
I agree.
And then at one point, she as the writer persona is in London thinking Sam Rockwell's character is out to kill her. She's out there, no passport, no money, no credit cards. What's she to do? She calls mom, and it's like, mom and dad are going to meet her in London. They're going to drop everything and come over.
Well, she calls the neighbor's cell phone.
Yes, she's smart enough to call the neighbor's cell phone on collect.
Have him take it over to mom and then doesn't tell Mom, step outside the house, even though she's done this because she's worried Mom's phone lines are bugged and the house might have cameras.
I don't think she was worried about the bugging the camera. I think it was just a matter of I can't pay for the call.
But if it were only that, she'd have called Mom's phone number. But she knew there were cameras in her house watching her, and she'd entered paranoia mode.
Did she know there was the cameras at that point? I thought that
cameras at that point.
That was the first thing she saw when we get to the cabin. You're right. Well, Mom and Dad show up in London, and Dad's out getting ice, and we haven't gotten the reveal of who Dad is yet. And I'm like, you know, he's going to be the head of the big evil organization, Bryan Cranston. And sure enough, he looks a little different, not like the evil leader of an organization, but the golly shucks, dad next door.
He's put on the Mr. Rogers sweater so that he can be incognito.
Yeah. There were parts of it that it's like, oh, he's looking over the code book they've got, and he's putting on glasses and pausing for each page. Golly, I wonder if he's taking pictures.
Yes.
Which, of course, they're not trying to hide from us.
Yes, yeah.
But there comes a point where there's a way to do it where that seems clever, and there's a way to do it that seems telegraphed.
Yeah.
And I felt they were more on the telegraphed side. And again, I couldn't tell if this was supposed to be a mix of fantasy world and the writer's real world. And I would say the best example of that I can think of, and we should rewatch this film, is Her Alibi, that Tom Selleck was in. It was, I want to say, in the 80s.
Yeah.
And he was a writer, and again, he sees events, and then it's like, oh, let me polish it up into this kind of a deal. But then meets somebody, and is she out to kill him? Is she not? Or I forget the details. Mm-hmm. It was a fun film. But that whole writer's reality thing seems to get chucked of, no, this really is that fantasy spy world. It's just she doesn't realize it.
Yeah.
And that lack of a clear identity for the film was problematic just in general. But when you set up the opening sequence and it's like, it's going to be this kind of a film. I mean, when we watched the trailer after the movie, because it's like, I want to see how they build this.
Yeah.
And at first I'm like, okay, it's looking like it's a Henry Cavill film. Cause that's what I was expecting.
Me too.
And he's in at the beginning. He does a couple of inner cuts. And then for a large stretch of the movie, he's nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
I felt one or two of the trailers played fair, one or two of the others, not so much.
Yeah.
And
well, and it was the longer trailers, like a minute plus trailers that played fair. One of them was
nearly 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I picked up the book because I'd seen one of the short trailers, Henry Cavill, it looked entertaining. And the cover of the book says, "The book that inspired the major motion picture." Now, I don't expect page for page to be the same as the screen. I don't even expect necessarily chapter to chapter.
They didn't even say base. They said inspired. So that gives some leeway right there.
You know, okay, so in the movie, our agents have been agents for a long time.
Well, she's been not an agent for 5 years and had been an agent for quite some time.
Okay. In the book, he is 5 years out of high school and being recruited to the CIA as a brand new agent.
In fairness, we do get that in the movie, in the tail end credit scene.
What we get in the movie is actually nothing to do with his getting recruited to the CIA.
Oh, okay.
That is actually a beautiful scene in the book. What happens, he's at boarding school in the UK, and he finds out that his parents have died in a plane accident in Thailand. And he remembers that his father told him in a postcard that there was a great little pub you could go to, you could get a certain drink with a twist, and he couldn't figure out why his dad told him that. So he goes there and does it. And the bartender tells him, basically, you're not of age to have the drink. And he's like, then just the twist.
Okay.
And the bartender pulls out the box and gives it to him. And when he opens it and sees what it's inside, he realizes this is one of those moments in life where you choose what kind of man you're going to be. Do you take what's in the box, which offers one definition of what kind of man you're going to be? Or do you close the box and tell the bartender, my mistake, and push it back?
which arguably is a very dangerous thing to do. Because now you know the secret and you're not buying in, so what's the bartender's reaction going to be? I think what colored my perception of that scene in the end credits area was it starts with a shot of the establishment. The Kingsman. And Matthew Vaughn, the director here, directed the Kingsman movies. And this is ostensibly a disconnected part of that universe somehow.
And see, I didn't realize that when I read the book.
I didn't realize that at all. And at some point, we need to rewatch the first Kingsman movie, watch the sequels and stuff, and see if there's anything that kind of connects these things together at all.
Yeah.
Not that there needs to be or whatnot, but I think with those, they were fun spy adventure movies in a James Bondish kind of a way. This had aspects of that, but was so over the top.
Well, in the book, they've got two things going on. They've got high level, they've got a mission they're out to do. And it ties back to we're looking for something that the Nazis looted and hid.
So a MacGuffin of some sort to go look for.
Okay. And the big, we have to find it, ticking time bomb, if you will, of this is that the person who is running for president of Russia and wants to be the equivalent of a Putin and is described very Putin-esque has said, I can find it. I will find it. And I will give it as a gift to the people of Russia. Because the Nazis stole it from Russia, and it's a Russian national treasure. So if he finds it, he becomes this...
the de facto leader at that point. He's the sure win.
Not just that, but he's like a Russian god in the eyes of the people. Because he doesn't claim it for him. He doesn't claim it for the presidency.
It's a PR coup on multiple levels for him. Yeah.
Right? So you've got that going on. But you've also got this team of CIA agents that Aubrey Argyle is put in with, that they're one man down because they had a traitor in their midst. And they think that traitor was found and put in jail. And the person running the team has pulled out the one person they knew was loyal and put them in a safe house, minding cameras. They're watching everybody while they try to figure out who the actual traitor is.
Narratively, I can see a number of directions to go with that. The most interesting of which would be the guy running the cameras is the traitor and setting everybody else up one by one.
So you're going through the whole book with this whodunit aspect.
Yeah. Do you recommend the book?
I enjoyed the book a lot.
Because it seems like that was the first, because they mentioned at the end that the sequel to this is going to be book one of the books that this author, we followed this movie, had written four and, you know, 95% of a fifth of.
Yeah. And this is the first book which we see the cover of in the movie. I enjoyed it, and honestly, I think it would make a great movie.
Well, what's interesting is the plan, at least originally, was for this to be a trilogy. We'll see if that comes to pass. But for the second part of the trilogy to be effectively book one out of five, this essentially was book five.
Yeah.
And then what do they do for the final part of the trilogy? Do they go in between, do book three, or do they do afterwards? And then how do you juggle a female Argyle here with a backstory of a male Argyle? And it's like, how is that connected to her?
Well, I mean, technically she was Rachel whatever.
Rachel Guile, yeah.
So, I mean, she's the fictional Argyle in the books, but she is not Aubrey Argyle.
Was there really an Aubrey Argyle, I guess?
We saw him at the end go into the pub to order the drink with the twist.
I get that. But is that scene in the fictional reality that we ended on when we saw the Henry Cavill and John Cena on the boat, or...
I think it's real, and we find out somewhere in books 2 through 5 that Rachel and Aubrey met.
Met, or she was the daughter of. There are a number of ways they could go, but there were aspects of this that really had me scratching my head of what's real, what's... Let me rephrase that. It's all fictional.
Yeah.
But what's fictional within the fictional?
Yeah, the play within the play.
A little meta right there.
Yeah. I don't remember a Rachel in the book. Kira was in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, but Kira was in both levels of the fiction.
Yeah.
The interior fiction with the Henry Cavill and John Cena stuff, and then the outer one with the Sam Rockwell and Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yeah. Now, Wyatt is in the book as Woody Wyatt.
And that was John Cena's character, I
yes. thought. Okay. Yes. But Aiden Wilde, Sam Rockwell, says, oh, but that's based on me.
Yeah. Well, she changed up the names.
But my point is, there is a Wyatt in the first book, the book I read. So they're playing fast and loose. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Well, it makes sense there would have been, because she was doing the fictionalized version, which would have been the Senna version of the character, even if it was based on the Sam Rockwell character's story. He was the inspiration for that one. The whole thing just gets ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think part of what makes this sort of movie hard to get good word of mouth is it can be hard to really describe to somebody.
Yes. Well, it's a confusing and convoluted movie. I mean, trying to describe the plot with the whole master file, there's no reason I can think of why there was a ticking time bomb or ticking clock of any sort on this master file, or why two sides were really racing for it.
Well, I think the ticking clock is you've got to get it first. Doesn't mean you got to get it now. You can wait 3 years if the other guy is going to take four. But now that somebody had a hot lead, then the race is back on.
I guess.
It would have been nice to have gotten a little bit of motivation for the directorate and some stuff like that.
I couldn't get over the fact that Bryan Cranston's character felt like he was perfectly willing to let Ellie get killed or die right up until the, oh yeah, I'm sorry, I've been pretending to be your father. I really shouldn't be letting them aim at you. I mean, I'm gonna, but I probably shouldn't.
Well, but even after that, you were always one of my favorite agents. You've always been loyal.
Yeah.
And we brainwashed you the whole time, so you should be even more loyal. Those are the sorts of things, the minute I stop and think about the plot, it starts to kind of unravel a little. It doesn't fall apart entirely, but I think that's because you've got a house of cards that's so complex and kind of overbuilt in some respects, there's not the room for the cards to fall down.
Yes.
And it's not that they've supported themselves.
Well, no, but when we were kids, we didn't just build a one-story house of cards. We built a two-story house of cards because we wanted to prove we could. And the thing is, when the top floor falls down, it simply becomes a bigger roof for the first floor.
Well, it either becomes that or it's got enough weight that it collapses the whole thing. And this is right at that balancing point.
Yeah.
Where it just takes, wait, what about?
Yeah.
To make the difference. And again, it's not bad. It's a lot of fun. But I think they went a little overboard in a few areas. And if they hadn't gotten so zany and wacky in a few places, and honestly, if the effects had been a little better in a couple of places, I could have taken the whole thing seriously.
Yeah.
And even the whole, she's got a cat, he's allergic to cats. Oh, she's really a dog person, but is she really? Because is she who she was or is she who she is now?
Yeah. And does she want to go back to who she was?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the answer was clearly no, because she turns on the directorate.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt the final question she gets in the book 5 Q&A with a hick version of Henry Cavill.
Yes.
I'm like, where the hell did they think they were going with that and why did they do it?
Yeah.
Because that left me with a, wait, what?
Yeah.
And that's not how you want people coming out of the theater. And that was followed by, again, that end credit scene of, wait, this ties into this other film? How? And I've been to some movies where people, myself included, came out confused. And there had to be a group discussion with somebody who had some additional information to explain, well, if you knew this, this would make sense and this is how it fits together and stuff like that. If you need a movie explained to you,
yeah,
that's not a good sign.
And yet we currently live in a culture where how often do you see a headline that says the showrunner breaks down or so-and-so explains and it's someone from a movie, a TV show, whatever.
Well, I've seen a ton of YouTube videos of what the ending of Thus and So really meant or the ending of Thus and So explained.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's one thing if it's coming out of the fan base. It's another when it's coming from the people on the production side. Like, they feel they didn't put enough on the screen, so yeah, they've got to step forward and tell us more.
I think both are indicative of a confusing narrative. One is at least the people on the production side taking ownership of that. Either way, it's not a good sign.
Yeah.
It's one thing if, hey, there's another layer. If you knew this, you might enjoy it more. And again, I enjoyed this film.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many times I was confused.
I enjoyed this film, but having read a book about a Nazi gold train and following clues that dated back to 60 years before World War II and yet managed to tie in to the Nazi gold train because people were that clever.
Well, I mean, I went into this expecting a Henry Cavill film.
Yes.
I got a Sam Rockwell film.
Yeah.
And he did good.
Yes, yes, but expectations matter.
And he was an interesting choice because at first when he was buried in the wig and the beard and stuff, I was thinking it was Noah Wiley.
Yeah.
Because he was acting just enough like that. And I think that might have been an interesting casting choice. But Sam Rockwell was also in, I forget the name of the film, but he played Chuck Berry of the Gong Show, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Who claimed to have been a spy, and there were definite similarities between that role and this role.
Yeah.
Is he really a spy? Is he not? Turns out here he was, there, who knows? There was the whole bit with him dancing and stuff that mm-hmm. kind of connected the two in my mind.
Yeah.
So, I also, there were a couple of places where Bryce Dallas Howard, she did a fine job here.
Yeah.
I do think they made a mistake when it's, oh, we've got to get dressed up for this. Suddenly her hairstyle radically changed.
Oh, I did not like that platinum blonde. It made her so pale. And then they went with the almost the vampire black eye makeup.
Yeah, it was a very different look for her.
Very unflattering for her, unfortunately.
Well, but it's like, what the hell happened? Who is, oh, I guess that's the same person, yeah, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But I was thinking that Kristen Bell could have really done a good job with this role, too.
The scene I really thought she did great in was up on the rooftop when Sam Rockwell is trying to convince her that they just, you know, just jump off the roof. No big deal. You're mm-hmm. right. You found the escape plan. And he grabs Alfie out of the cat backpack.
It's like, trust me, it's got to have a fall mat or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And drops the cat and the cat's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now the cat weighs a fraction of what they're going to weigh.
And they don't encourage the cat to move out from where they're going to fall to, and they fall backwards.
They jump, they fall. The cat seems to bounce all the way up to the roof.
Yes.
I don't think that's how that works.
It's not how that works. But her reaction to the cat falling.
Oh, yeah.
Priceless.
It was well shot. There were a few things that were very blatantly CG, but it's like, how else are you going to do this?
Uh-huh.
But it's when we get the cat coming up to the camera back up at the top of the roof, and it's like, this is over the top.
Yes, yes.
This is comedy, not spy action adventure.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell which identity the film was going for.
The film didn't know, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is the problem. It's one thing when I can't tell. It's another thing when I feel the film can't tell.
The problem is, I think the director had a vision and stuck to it and was happy with the results, is the impression I get.
Yeah.
But I think his vision was very unclear to me.
Well, going back to the books, they won't reveal who really wrote the book.
And I get when you're doing an in-universe novelization and selling it out of universe. Again, hard to talk about.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we've seen the same thing when Richard Castle from the Castle TV show had books out.
Yeah.
It's like, he's not real, and I know Nathan Fillion didn't write these.
Yeah.
So, I get that, but when you plaster on the cover of said book, inspiring the movie...
Yes.
...that it was written to market...
Yeah.
...that's a complete reversal of what's happening here.
Thank you. And that's what threw me.
To me, that's deceptive marketing.
The chicken and the egg were backwards for me.
Yeah. Well, it's dishonest marketing.
Well, if they had put on the cover as seen in the movie Argyle.
As featured in. Or,
yeah. I still would have read it. I still would have enjoyed it. But I would have understood where it fit in relation to the plot of the movie.
Well, and again, if you're thinking this is based on a character, the movie starting out with that character.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, what the hell?
And they purposely released the book ahead of the movie to encourage the hype.
Yeah.
Which means I can't be the only person who sat down to watch the movie and said, wait, what?
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's some people would say, oh, but you must have seen every trailer and all the commercials for it, so you knew exactly what you were getting into. And I'm like, no. If I did that, why would I go see the film? I know what I'm getting. You know?
Yeah.
There are some where it's like, oh, that trailer looks interesting, or I've heard good things about it, or, hey, I know the actor and, you know, it's a director I've seen good stuff from. That's enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or I've got a vague sense it's a spy-ish sort of thriller thing. So I think the marketing I had seen around the time it came out had no indication for me that we were going to be following the author of the character. I thought we were following the character in that he wasn't really the spy he was made out to be. So I was expecting the pretender kind of a spy or whatever, the imposter almost. And again, got a very different film than I had kind of made up in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Having seen, again, the trailer after we watched the film, the full trailer, I think was, I'm not going to say relatively true to the film, because I don't think it captured the tone, the style, but it played fair and had enough things from enough parts of the film that I don't feel that was, if I had seen that and said, let's watch it, I don't feel it would have been a bait and switch.
Yeah.
Incomplete information, absolutely, but what the minimal buzz that I had gotten versus the film I just watched, that was very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when that happens, a lot of people are going to feel bait and switch, that it wasn't a good movie. Even though it was entertaining, it wasn't what they set out to watch.
Yeah.
And I definitely feel it wasn't what I set out to watch, but I enjoyed the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say I liked this film.
Yeah.
I am not saying, and I want to be very clear on this, I'm not saying it's a good film.
Well, I thought I was going to get a cross between espionage and a heist, and I don't feel I got that. So while I enjoyed what I got, I didn't get what I sat down for.
I can see that entirely, because while there were spies in the film, I don't think we got much of any traditional quote-unquote spy craft.
Mm-mm.
That we would get in a James Bond or a Mission Impossible or something of that ilk.
We didn't get any dead drops.
Didn't get any impersonations, didn't get any kind of clandestine stuff. It was a scavenger hunt with fight scenes.
The only real gadget we had was the one pair of glasses.
And that was more alluded to than really truly seen. The only high-tech device I would say we got, and I use this loosely, are the computers in the directorate base that are the clear acrylic monitors.
Yeah. We had the retired spymaster who had his office behind doors that looked like a wall, but when you slid them open, the room was twice as big as you realized.
He had a cool man cave, yeah.
Yeah, it was cool.
But so did the directorate director.
Okay, now the doctor back at the directorate.
I love when we see the doctor. She's interrogating Sam Rockwell's character. And she's doing that in her lab because she's the psych, the brainwasher and such. Behind him in the lab is the kitchen that she would do the FaceTime from when the author would, mm-hmm. Hey, Mom, you know.
Yeah. When you wanted to FaceTime, but I needed to be at work. This was what we built to compromise.
Had it recreated.
Oh, so funny.
Yeah. It had some fun moments like that, but again, if it was a bit more of a spoof of a spy thing, I could have rolled with that a lot easier. I mean, it made perfect sense, and it was, from a serious point of view, infinitely practical in terms of, yes, I could see you doing this, spending the money, getting it recreated, the impossible logistics of most spy organizations in fictional realms.
Yes.
Comes into play. But it was, well, even when we got the reveal of this big base that they've got is an oil tanker, apparently.
Yes.
It's like I knew it was a ship of some sort, but it begged the question of fuel up the jet. I was expecting it to at least be an aircraft carrier or something of how did he get to the jet.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's worth watching this if you can go in with a very open mind, have fun with it, treat it like a roller coaster ride, most of it's going to pull together.
Yeah.
Sort of, but not quite.
Yeah.
If you hate meta stories, avoid this.
Yeah.
If you're looking for something that is a great showcase for Henry Cavill, this isn't it.
No. Same with John Cena.
Oh, John Cena's a cameo in this, a glorified cameo at best. He did a fine job with the few minutes he got.
Mm-hmm.
John Cena was essentially playing a literally beefed up version of the Tom Arnold role from True Lies. The guy in the van, etc. Except here, when the person's zipping by on the moped or the motorcycle, he's big enough, strong enough, he can just grab the person off the bike, which was a great scene.
It was. And it interrupted his coffee, which yes. He played well, too.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting because by the time we circle back to that scene with the quote-unquote real people in it,
mm-hmm.
It had been long enough since we'd seen it because it had been better part of 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's how that played out. And kind of bringing things back full circle-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So, how long is the book? How many pages?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me double check. It was a pretty good length. I want to say it was over 200 pages. 368.
At 200 pages, I would consider reading it. At 368, I would need a really good recommendation to read it.
I really enjoyed it. But like I said, and part of it is, I enjoy things like the hunt for a Nazi gold train. They brought in the Amber Room, which was stolen from Catherine Palace and has been missing since the war.
Yeah, but a lot of that history would be lost on me, to be honest.
I mean, it was a great hunt for where could the Nazis have hidden this
well, it almost for these sounds decades. A lot like the Blood and Treasure TV show that we watched.
Yes.
And if it's a good version of that sort of a story, that could be a lot of fun. But if I had gone in with those expectations to this movie...
And you just hit it right on the head.
And that's where it's like, I thought I was getting A and I got B. B's not bad, but it sure as hell isn't what I set out to get.
Yes. And that's where I'm at.
Yeah. I think the problem with this film, beyond the unclear directorial vision, was the way they marketed it.
Yeah.
They didn't own up to what it was, and if they had embraced that in the marketing, and I realized it was going to be about a spy, but really that's a fictional character, and it's about the author, and, you know, where did she get these ideas? She's, you know, is she a spy? Is she not? Kind of a thing. If I'd gone in with that mindset, I probably would have loved it even more than I did, and I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not a horrible film. It's very enjoyable. Is it a good, well-written, et cetera, film? No, I can't really say that.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
Yes.
And I've got to pick between good and fun and enjoyable. I'll lean on the fun and enjoyable.
Yeah.
It does have me curious if it's got decently viable ties to the Kingsman movies. So we should rewatch the first one, watch the sequels, and maybe record on the sequels. Because again, we've already done Kingsman the Secret Service almost a decade ago now. I guess 2016, so 8 years ago.
And I do hope they make the book into a movie.
They certainly promised to at the end, so if they don't, I'll be disappointed. And if they do, I'll certainly watch it. But I'm going to need a little bit of an explanation of, is this the in-universe fictional story? In other words, do we see these characters watching the film?
Well, but I really think the way they were setting it up with that 20 years ago is some of the books are her memories, and some of the books are things she learned while working for them. So whether this is her telling someone else's story, as you said, she could be telling her father's story.
That's not what they claim here is the problem.
Yes, and I agree.
Then if it's 20 years earlier and it's going to be the next film, they need to connect the dots.
Somehow.
As to how is it a prequel to this?
Yeah.
And that's the part that, again, I'm still perplexed by. But I was entertained enough that I'll give it a chance, but if they don't connect the two, mm-hmm. would I watch another sequel? But, I don't know.
I mean, the book has drug runners in Thailand. It has glitz and glamour party in Monte Carlo.
The globe hopping that this didn't really do.
Well, but more than that, it's got...
Well, the cliche spy scenes.
There you go.
The casino, the big party, the gala.
Yeah. Yeah.
The glitz, I mean, the glamour, yeah.
Here we had the fancy gold dress And the going into the Arabian palace, they had virtually nobody in it.
But it wasn't a party. It was, this is the keeper of secrets. It's a glorified safety deposit box.
Yes.
Why did you have to dress up for this and go in the middle of nowhere?
Yes.
If this were hidden in a venue that's known for the big parties and stuff like that, sure, but it wasn't.
Whereas in the book, they have to go to Monte Carlo, where there's going to be a limited time exhibit of all the most expensive jewelry in the world that's privately owned at one of the most expensive hotels in Monte Carlo.
Well, it's interesting.
And you have to dress the part of fitting there.
Yeah, and that would make sense. When we're in London, it didn't feel like the iconic parts of London.
It felt like the dockyards.
It did. It didn't feel like the spy James Bond London.
Yeah.
When we were, quote-unquote, in Hong Kong, it honestly didn't feel like the actors were there at all. It was blatantly green screened, and it had to be because it's like we're going to shoot fireworks and we're going to roll it back.
Yeah.
But they didn't sell me on the foreign locales, even when we're suddenly in France. Really? We're not just out in the boonies of
Napa
England?
Valley?
Napa Valley or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
I go back to I enjoyed it. I think they could have done and should have in some areas done better. But it's worth watching. It sounds like the book's probably worth reading, too.
Yeah. I enjoyed the book more than the movie. Not to say that the movie was bad, but just the book was a higher bar.
Yeah, and I could see where those preconceived notions were fighting against the movie you were watching.
Yeah.
Interesting. Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, please spread the word about the Comic Book Page podcast by telling your friends and posting a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please, join our Slack community and let us know what you thought of this episode. I do this podcast because I enjoy talking about comics. So let's talk about comics. The show notes, forum, and instructions for how to join our Slack channel can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. The opinions of the co-hosts and guests are their own. The Comic Book Page podcast is copyright John Mayall. And thanks again for listening.